You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNRadio.com. And be sure to share.
Before we start today's episode, on March 19th, I'll be hosting a webinar titled Developing Leadership at Every Level, an Improvisational Approach. You can sign up by going to www.secondcityworks.com, click on the feed, and scroll down to find the link. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Carol Trigiano. Carol has been a teacher at the Chicago Waldorf School for the past 25 years. She graduated from National Lewis University and taught for several years in both public and private schools. She is a graduate of the Arcturus Waldorf Teacher Training Program, where she teaches a variety of courses. Carol taught early childhood before becoming a grades teacher and has completed two rounds of first through eighth grade, as well as fifth through eighth grade class. Is that old bio or is that current?
That's right.
That's right. Okay. This year, she picked up a sixth grade class. Carol regularly visits other Waldorf schools as an outside evaluator, lecturer, and mentor. She has served as the chair of the College of Teachers, AWSNA delegate, and on numerous administrative and pedagogical committees. Important to me because she was my daughter, Nora Leonard's teacher. Carol Trigiano, welcome to the show.
Hello. Happy to be here, Kelly. One little correction.
Yeah.
I picked up the current class in sixth grade, and now they're in eighth grade. So they're almost ready to be launched in
the
high
school. Another one going out?
Maybe, yes. Yes, they're going out.
That's exciting.
Yeah, very exciting.
All right, so we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff, but one of the things, this keeps coming up with folks I meet out in the world, and this happened yesterday, where I was having a conversation with someone who was participating in a session that I was at, and then it turns out that her kids go to Waldorf. And I get this a lot for the people who don't know, is like, what is a Waldorf school? How is that different from other kinds of schools?
Great. Well, Waldorf Education, actually, this year is celebrating its 100th anniversary. So it started in Germany in 1919, and it is the fastest-growing independent school movement in the world. So there's Waldorf schools in places like China, Central America, South America, so of course, all over the United States. So it's been around a long time. And I think what I would say is that Waldorf Education, in a nutshell, really is about giving the child not just a very strong sort of academic education and all the things that you would expect, but also there's this really great emphasis on the development of imagination and creativity. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of schools, as we see by, you know, this sort of obsession with testing, really tend to focus a lot on information. You know, how many facts can we kind of get into a child's head? And while information is certainly important, we know that in the age we live, that information changes. I mean, I don't even know how many planets are left today. I have no idea.
They keep changing.
They keep changing all the time, mm-hmm. right? So information is going to change. And so that puts us as teachers kind of in this interesting position of like, well, how are we going to really prepare our children, who some of them are 5 or 7 or 15, to be able to really step out into the world and kind of make their way. And so what we really try to emphasize is this learning, certainly, like I said, all the strong academic skills, but then at the same time, trying to help them develop things that social scientists are now calling soft skills. So mm-hmm. things like perseverance and initiative and a sense of responsibility and something you're super interested in, like collaboration. You know, how do we prepare them to not step into hierarchical situations, but how do we learn to help them? How do we help them really learn to work together in a collaborative way? And I think one of the other interesting things about us is that we have what we describe as a developmental curriculum. So what's the right thing? What do we think is the right thing for a child at the age of 7, for the child at the age of 11, and how's that different for somebody who's 15? And that curriculum is certainly evolving, to, you know, keep up with the modern world and, you know, latest research. But there are still some things that I think we believe sort of speak to children at different ages. So the young child we know really lives in the world of doing. I mean, you can't take a kid to grandma's house and say, sit there and don't touch anything, right? Mm-hmm. They learn through experience. And so in those younger grades, it's really about play, mm-hmm. about learning through play. And again, a lot of the latest brain research that's coming out today is saying, yeah, that's exactly right. Early childhood play really leads to, you know, higher levels of critical thinking later on. And, you know, a young child certainly can think and has a lot of a very rich sort of social emotional life, but really does learn by doing. And then as the child gets a little bit older, the thinking begins to develop, but they're still not at this place where they can really conceptualize things or abstract. If you try to have a logical conversation with a 10-year-old, you're not going to get anywhere, mm-hmm. right? And so the emphasis is still about experiential learning, but also really paying attention to what is this whole social emotional world about? You know, how do we get along? How do we work together? How do we learn to respect each other's feelings? What do we learn about compassion and empathy? In this context of, you know, learning the skills that you need to learn. And then somewhere, you know, around 13, 14, this capacity to think, really to be able to take a step back and reflect and abstract is born. And so the high school curriculum is really developed to sort of crystallize that in the child. And so if we can, you know, work at our goal to kind of help young people develop over time this ability to put things into action, really get out there and not be afraid to have new experiences, to be able to relate to others in a healthy way, and then be able to, you know, think, you know, terrible term that everybody's using, but like out of the box, you mm-hmm. know, in new creative ways, then hopefully they're able to kind of step out of high school and put some direction and purpose to their lives.
I think we gotta have a better term than soft skills. This should be a goal of the podcast now, because it, you know, and this is the thing. Early childhood is amazing at Waldorf. And I don't know anyone who doesn't think that. I mean, some people leave the school, and we're going to get to some Waldorf myth busting because I'm interested in talking about that. But what happened in early childhood is, you know, there is cooking and there's ironing. So there's a smell and there's play and there's silks and wood blocks. And there are things that are you could conceive of as soft. But I also recall this happened with both my kids, which is like they would try to run away at some point.
Oh, yes.
And Laura Dunkel, their early childhood teacher, would grab them and pull them in. And it was this wonderful, tough, courageous. I mean, they talk about risky play. And it's not just all soft. There's hard edges to it.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the other skills that we're really looking at is resilience, right? Yeah. This ability to fall down, you're going to be okay, get up and keep going, mm-hmm. right? Don't feel like you're going to be toppled in one way or the other. I think that's another part of a strong Waldorf curriculum is like you have a lot of responsibility and a lot of and all the joys that comes with kind of directing how you're going to learn in any kind of situation. And so absolutely, I think that teachers also, you know, understand the importance of boundaries and mm-hmm. Giving children sort of things to kind of bump up against, push yourself a bit. Mm-hmm. Jump for the bar a little bit higher. And you touched on something that I think is also important in Waldorf education. You know, sometimes talking about myths a little bit, you know, there's this idea that we're an art school, right? Yeah, we just sit around and we paint all day long and mm-hmm. we, you know, do clay modeling. Mm-hmm. And yes, I think the arts are super, super important in our school. And I think it's not out of like, we're not in the business of trying to, you know, create artists for the future, although some kids do end up doing that. But think about what happens when a child, whether you're 5 or 9 or 15, experience is an art medium. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you face like a blank canvas or a blank piece of paper or a hunk of wood or a piece of stone or a piece of clay, you know, you're basically charged with like taking nothing and turning it into something.
Yeah.
And that is a deed of courage.
Sure, that's improv.
That is a deed of courage. Yeah. I mean, putting down that first drop of paint, mm-hmm. like, or making that dig into the wood. I remember one of my colleagues, Frances Vig, she was doing woodworking with one group, and one boy was really digging at the wood. And she's like, you know, I think you got to ease up a bit. You're trying to make a bowl here. Mm-hmm. And he kept digging and digging. And in one of the classes, he dug a hole right through it.
Yeah.
And he came up, he said, look at my bowl. And she's like, well, I guess now you have a candle holder,
yeah.
right? So isn't that like metaphoric of life, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I always like try to think of the arts as like you, in a great sense, we kind of, as individuals, have the opportunity to kind of paint the canvas of our lives. And sometimes it goes great and it goes beautifully, and then sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. But you've got to figure out, how am I going to put this texture into who I am? And I think that that daily sort of dose of facing the unknowable and facing something that takes a lot of courage builds up this muscle for, yeah, I'm going to face the tough things of life. I'm going to handle it. I'm going to figure it out. It might not always be easy, but I'm going to go forward and tackle it.
So Waldorf myth busting, this is the number one thing I heard when parents would not stay, which was not many.
Yeah.
But they were always worried that their kids wouldn't learn to read and write.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that the number one thing?
Like, I think so. Although we've come up with, a couple of written pieces, brochures on our approach to literacy, right?
Yeah.
Our approach to literacy. So, yes, kids in Waldorf schools do learn to read and write. And that is that's one component of literacy.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you have to do to kind of get the soil ready so that a child can learn how to read and write?
Mm-hmm.
So let's just back up a little bit. As you know, and as I'm passionate about, storytelling is a hugely important component in a Waldorf school. And so when a child is 3, 4, 5, 6 years old in the early childhood, every day, every single day, that child is listening to a story that's told by the teacher, an oral story,
mm-hmm.
right? Not a book that's read. There's nothing wrong with books, but we're trying to get something else going here. So the child listens to that story every day. And so what is happening when a 5-year-old is listening to a story, let's say? So the child is attending to, a story's about somebody. It's about characters. And it takes place somewhere. It's a setting. And, there's usually a problem. You know, don't go off the path to pick the flowers. And then there's usually some sort of resolution. And so those qualities, those are what you get in any story,
mm-hmm.
right? And so when the child is attending to a story, what the child is doing is developing this inner capacity to hold on to the thread of a story. Hold on to the thread.
Mm-hmm.
Now, reading is two things. Mm-hmm. It's comprehension and it's decoding. And unless your child has some sort of learning difference, decoding is actually, even in English, fairly simple to learn. The hard part is comprehending.
Hmm.
The hard part is picking up Moby Dick and holding on to it for 500 pages. But the child in our school in early childhood and in first grade and in second grade is building up this inner capacity to create a whole world out of story,
mm-hmm.
inwardly. And that's what builds good comprehension. So by the time we do those decoding skills, which happens, you know, the end of first grade, beginning of second grade, the kids are like, okay, we can get this. We can understand how to put, you know, how a sound out a word. But I also know that a story has a beginning, a middle, and end.
Now, I know you didn't teach Nick, my son Nick, directly, but you knew
him. Absolutely.
So he had trouble reading, but he, from the time he was born, it was story, right?
Yeah.
He listened to story tapes and all that stuff. And you brought up Moby Dick. I bring this up because I had this conversation with him. It was last semester, because he's a senior now at Skidmore, and he was reading Moby Dick. And I'm like, my teacher let me skip the whaling chapters. There's like 4 chapters of just whaling. It's excruciating. And later Nick's like, I really enjoyed the Wailing chapter. And I'm like, well, this circle is complete here. So, I mean, it took him a while because I think there was some level of learning disability that we're all trying to figure out. But he had the hard stuff.
Yes.
He got that. So by the time that, you know, his I don't know if you call it skill or whatever, was in a place where he could apply it, you know, he's reading the Wailing chapters of Moby Dick.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because he learned how to create that world. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're doing. We're trying to do this inner picture so that now you can really gain something meaningful out of what you're reading.
I don't know if, you know, I doubt that you've done this, but I'll ask. You haven't, like, Googled, like, Eurythmy jokes, Chicago Waldorf.
No, but my adult children have.
So let's... Eurythmy. All right. Every time I start to make fun of Eurythmy with people who don't know, I mean, it's very hard to explain.
It's so, very hard.
So let's start there. Can you explain what Eurythmy is in a Waldorf context?
Yes, I will try my best.
Okay.
So, you know, as you know, someone who's worked in improv and has worked in theater, that how a person moves in space has an impression. It mm-hmm. carries a very deep impression. The way you enter a room, the way you stand before an audience, this sort of ability to kind of embody your own body, right, is an important skill. Mm-hmm. So eurythmy is movement, first of all, to either music or poetry, in which we're really trying to help the students develop this sense of their place in space. So how do I move forward, which is one way? How do I move backwards? Mm-hmm. How do I move side to side and feel my connection to the space, but in community of others? And so I really think if you want to imagine eurythmy, imagine a geometrical shape on the floor, a 8-pointed star, 5-pointed star, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you have a child, a student standing on every one of those points, and to music or movement or poetry, they're trying to get from A to B to C to D to E and back mm-hmm. home, right? And so I always think of eurythmy really as a metaphor for modern living. Okay. In other words, like I have to hold my space. I have to hold my focus. Like I've got to get from A to B to C to D to E, but mm-hmm. and I want to get there, but I have to pay attention to everybody else who's around me because I don't want to crash into somebody else. I don't want to block somebody. I don't want to get in somebody's way so that they can't get where they need to go. And so this constant sort of exercise of, you know, me feeling comfortable in my body, feeling balanced, feeling upright. You know yourself, like if you look at somebody who's kind of slunched over, you kind of read that person in a different way. We're trying mm-hmm. to get kids to stand upright, right? Mm-hmm. Stand upright, hold your space, but yet pay attention to the people that are around you. And so it can be this sort of artistic experience of community, I think, of paying attention to one another and really being able to hold your own focus.
All right. Well, that actually... That sounds good, but it does kind of look ridiculous sometimes.
Are we on?
Yep.
So, yes, I think sometimes it does look ridiculous, but I have also seen performances with students where, you know, when the beautiful classical music and these beautiful colored robes and when they're moving on stage, it can look like a painting. So, yes, I see both sides of it.
Well, and as you're talking, I got to be honest, as you're talking about it, it's dawning on me something I hadn't considered, which I think is important, which is that Waldorf, you know, when you talk about treating the whole child,
right.
You are extending that metaphor beyond, I think, how most people think of it, because I think most people think about the whole child being, yeah, the child's mind, body, and spirit. Yes, you're tending to that. You're also tending to that child in relation to everything else.
Right.
Physical world,
right.
Other people.
Right.
And this is a thing, this has come up with you know, some of the psychologists we've had on and artists and authors, a lot of the academics, which is we tend to forget that we are completely related. That
right.
human beings are social creatures, and this is the thing we know in improvisation because we teach you in constant collaborative mode because right. we are not alone even when we're alone.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And that I do think is unique to yeah. from my experience to Waldorf.
I also think that this idea of having the same teacher sort of carry a class for right. several years contributes to that too, because like my first two classes, I actually had them from first through eighth grade. Now, that doesn't mean that I taught them everything. I taught them a lot of main lesson, morning lesson blocks of study, and then they had other special subject teachers. So it's not like they were locked in a room with me every day from 8 to 3.
Right.
But nevertheless, I really got to know those students deeply, and then having a class 5 through 8, like with Eleanor, and then on this class 6 through 8, I mean, you just develop a different kind of class community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no time wasted in September about who's this teacher or who are these kids. Like,
right.
you know each other. And you also have this intimate connection with the parents, which, of course, is also supporting the education of the child. But I think this sort of bonding that can happen when you have the same class teacher for several years really creates this sense of, you know, we're a community here.
Mm-hmm.
We got to figure out how to work this out. And new kids come, of
yeah.
course, all along the way. I've got a new girl this year, right? And kids go.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's also this flexibility of, like, how do we bring people into this clan?
So I was reading an article that you wrote, and I've told this story on the podcast before, but so I'll do it really quickly for you, which was in my book, Yes, And, I talked about how the U.S. Department of Education brought us in. And we were they wanted us to try to create some sort of event, scene, moment that would allow these groups that normally fight together in a room. And I believe it was the U.S. Department, so the government, it was principals, and it was the unions.
Oh, yeah.
And so what could we do? And as we started doing our research, we found that there was not a lot of commonality in terms of what they each thought was important. So we're like, okay, so let's reverse that. What do you all hate? And so we found what it was. And so this conference opened up, and they announced that these experts from Finland were going to come in and talk about education.
Yeah.
And they all hate that because they're constantly told how great Finland is. So we came in with, like, blue hair and really pretentious accents talking about our Finnish education and how stupid you Americans were. And they knew it was Second City. So it was like, it was a bonding moment over their common, just pure seething hatred of Finnish educators. And it's probably because they are pretty awesome in terms of their educational system,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So talk to us about what's that experience.
They do a lot of the same things that Waldorf schools do. I went to, at one point during the Humanities Festival, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the man's name, but he was the head of the superintendent of schools in Finland. And I was sitting listening to this lecture, and I was just going crazy because I was like, this is what we do. So first of all, they don't, quote, teach reading to 3 and 4 year olds. They wait until the children are around 7 or 8 years old. They do that. They have looping, which is carrying the same teachers for several years. They don't do any standardized testing over there until I think the kids are around 17. None.
Mm-hmm.
We do some in sixth grade. We do it in sixth and seventh grade. And then this sort of also this importance of the arts, right? How do we incorporate the arts into the curriculum was another component that was very important to them.
And outside play.
And a lot of outdoor activity.
Yeah, right? Even in cold weather.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's another thing that was very cool in my experience was this, again, the and there's research to back this up in terms of our sense of awe, which is in relation to nature,
right.
And experiencing it. And, like, you know, you have to buy some snowsuits. I mean, it's not, you know.
Absolutely.
This is a thing. You know, you've got to make sure that they're prepared for being outside, which is also a good, you know, quality to to have.
We had a teacher for several years. She was from Norway, and she was like, "There's no such thing as bad weather. There's just bad clothing."
All right, that's a good phrase.
Yeah.
All right, like, what your path? Like, what was the moment you maybe, like, right before you knew about Waldorf? Or, like, how'd you end up in this world?
Yeah. So I knew I wanted to be a teacher very young. I kind of figured out that I liked kids way better than I liked grown-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to National. I studied there and taught. Then had our own children. I had two kids. And when I was at National, I studied under a woman named Betty Weeks, who was sort of the grand dame of storytelling on the North Shore. And she really got me hooked on the art of storytelling. So when I got my first jobs in public and private school, I, of course, followed the curriculum and did all the textbooks and did all the testing. But I told myself that every day before the kids went home, I was going to tell them a story, an oral story. So I told myths, fairy tales, folk tales, whatever I could find. And I started to notice that they became better readers and they became better writers and their vocabulary expanded and they became better listeners and they liked me more and respected me more.
Mm-hmm.
And they also would go home and tell the stories that they had heard one time to their parents. So I had one kid, I remember he had a lot of learning differences, and I met his parents for the conference, and they were like, how is he learning these stories? And I was like, well, I don't know what you're talking about. And she's like, well, every night at dinner, he tells us a different story. And I'm like, well, I tell a story at 2:45 before they go home. Could not believe that he could retain the story and be able to tell it. And she started actually crying, and she said, you know, he's my third child, and his brothers are pretty hard on him, but this is the first time I've ever seen the big boys listen to him. And I feel like I knew that the power of storytelling was so, so incredibly important in the learning experience, and not just in all those things like reading and writing, but in what it means to be a human being. I mean, how do you teach what compassion is and what empathy is, and how do you allow a child to walk in another person's shoes? To me, that was all about storytelling. So I knew nothing about Waldorf education. I ran into an acquaintance. She said, what have you... So I was a stay-at-home mom for a while. She says, well, what are you doing, you know, besides being stay-at-home? And I said, well, I do a lot of freelance storytelling, and I teach teachers on the art of storytelling. And she said, oh, you should check out Waldorf. So I looked it up. I went to an orientation. My colleague, Frances Vig, who's still at the school, was giving the orientation. At one point, she said, the entire curriculum stands on the foundation of storytelling. And I said, that's it. I didn't care. I could not care less about anything else. I was like, I'm in. I'm totally in. And so I became a parent, and then they found out I had a degree in education, and they sort of
got their
hooked me in, and I've been incredibly blessed and happy in this career. It was a perfect thing for me.
Do you remember when you first met Eleanor?
I do remember when I first met Eleanor. She was not in my class yet.
Nope.
She was younger. And she was running around on the playground.
Headscarf
on. And she came up to, I remember this, she came up to me to complain about one of the kids in my class who was older than she was, who was giving her a hard time. And I remember, like, kind of taking her very seriously, but inwardly just being like, oh my God, who is this adorable little elfin person? Because she, first of all, she spoke so directly to me.
Right.
Like she didn't really know me.
No.
You know, I was a teacher of the big kids.
Mm-hmm.
And yet she was like, oh no, you better handle this. And I'm like, Miss Eleanor, I will handle this. I will take care of it.
A beginning of a great relationship. I ask you that because I want to talk a bit about, the project.
Right.
So, and Carol, you know, Nora, in those sort of last couple months, and we didn't really know they were going to be the last couple months, but she was pretty selective about the people that she wanted to see, and she was always good to see you.
It was wonderful.
And you and Andrea came over and got to hang with her, and she got to make fun of Andrea. Yeah,
absolutely.
Which was a great parting shot on her part. But, you know, I mean, we were all, you know, devastated in a variety of different levels when she passed. And, you know, I don't know where you were. I mean, I know you read some of my writing when I
Absolutely.
Talk about this, right? And so I was talking about that place where to put her. Do you recall how this came together from your end, where Nora's Sun and Moon Park sort of began?
Well, I remember reading, you know, this article
that Heidi wrote. Yeah.
And then where you made this comment about, I wish I could buy the other building, right?
Yeah.
And
right.
And create something there.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, it just sort of like, it just took on a life of its own. Like I'm bumping into, you know, Dana Hedgedorn, and I'm talking to other people, Becky, and it's like, you know, we could possibly make this sort of happen,
mm-hmm.
right? You know? And so it just felt like this organic kind of thing of like, we need a place for Nora. This is a very big spirit, right, who embodied in every possible way what Waldorf education is about, in every possible way. You know, her own resilience, her own sort of love of movement and love of nature and willing to take on new challenges, like grab it by the horns and run with it. This playful yet serious academic, also yet artistically gifted person who just like embodies what Waldorf education is really about.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we create a space to like honor that spirit of mm-hmm. who she is in her, also not just her as the individual, but what she represents
right.
in terms of what a Waldorf kid is,
mm-hmm.
what a pure sort of Waldorf kid is. I remember, like, I mean, so, there's just so many stories, but I remember, so I, in her class, the class I had, there were 28 of them, and they were, you know, they were, they're a vibrant, vivacious, you know, full of energy,
yep.
full of opinions bunch.
Mm-hmm.
And so she came to me, like, I think at the end of sixth grade or the beginning of seventh grade, and she caught me alone, and she said, you know, I'm going to teach myself how to be a real artist this year. I'm going to learn how to draw. This year I'm going to learn. Because she was great, and she mm-hmm. did fine, but there were quite a few kids in there that, you know, were sort of born with these
yep.
extra gifts. And I was like, good for you, Eleanor, go for it. And by the end of seventh grade, I mean, she was producing a quality of work that was just, like, exceptional.
Right.
Exceptional. And she had that kind of energy about a lot of things,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah, give me the lead in the eighth grade play. I can do this. Ton of lines. Don't worry. I'm going to handle it.
Yeah, her first words were, I do it.
There you go.
And like, I play guitar, but she didn't ask me to teach her guitar. She just said, give me your guitars, which is what I did. And the rest was her and YouTube.
Yeah.
So talk to us. Let's talk about the outdoor space, because, you know, there's going to be a benefit on May 2nd that we're holding in Chicago, and people can get information at the Waldorf website about that. And we'll mention it on here as well. But what are you trying to build in her name? Talk to us about because it's kind of a tremendous idea.
It's a tremendous idea. You know, so we want a space. We want outdoor space is incredibly important to a Waldorf curriculum on many different levels. As you said, like, there's this connection to nature, especially these kids grow up in concrete, right? Our kids are concrete kids. God bless them. We love it. We've chosen this. They've chosen this. But we want them to be able to experience, you know, sort of the beauty of nature, to be able to see, you know, experience science outside, right? To see what it's like to have a garden. So there's this sort of element of nature. And then there's this element of just play, right? Areas with probably, you know, with places where children can climb, places where kids can tumble, places where kids can build things up and take things down, places where kids can, like, take challenges, jump over certain areas that might be too far for them, right? So this sort of pushing of the boundary in a healthy kind of way that, again, builds up this resilience and this sort of fearless kind of quality. A place where we could do, you know, we could take high school kids outside to maybe do some drama work, right? Or also, you know, a quiet space where maybe if you want a little time to just kind of sit by yourself and mm-hmm. take the world in, that can be out there too. But all of these components that really will kind of richly allow the kids to kind of be outside and move a lot, but also spark their imagination and their creativity. I think that also is a component of what we want this space to be for the kids.
When we were at one of the events at Waldorf, because one of the components is a fire pit.
Yeah.
And I thought the story was amazing, where they were talking about when... So the school is at Ashland and Foster. It's the old Trumbull school, which was empty for a while. Then it was going to become something else, and then Waldorf got it. And the story they were telling about the contractors, the people who were working on it, they sort of kind of own the building in the process, right?
Yeah,
when it was
yeah.
being renovated. But a bunch of Waldorf community members wanted to come in and volunteer to help paint, and they were like, yeah, that's fine, expecting that they'd have, like, what, like 10 parents show
yeah,
up?
Yeah, right.
And they had something like 100
people
who came every day.
Yeah.
And really, these contractors, like, developed this heart for the project. And as they were talking about building this fire pit, they were saying it's a lost art. Yeah. And so they basically invited any of the kids or parents who wanted to follow the process that they could come into it, which is more work for them.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But what a like drinking the Kool-Aid by out, which is, you know, what happens. And so, yeah, the other aspect about this in Andersonville is that while Waldorf is going to be raising money to build this Nora Sonnen Moon Park, it's also going to be open to the community.
Absolutely. This has really been important to us since we, you know, feel so blessed to have gotten this building and to be in this community, which is so vibrant, and to be really open to come and join us, come and play here, come and let your child experience what our children are going to be able to experience every day, and, you know, become a part of the community. I think that was important to us from the beginning, from the very beginning when we were pursuing this facility, that we really wanted it to be this sort of heart space. Come be a part of us. You know, we're a part of you. You're a part of us.
So there's going to be a benefit in May 2nd. And then also the 100th anniversary is going to be celebrated at Chicago Waldorf.
Yes. So this is the 100th anniversary, and we are holding a conference there at the end of June. And we're probably going to have 1,000 Waldorf teachers from all over the world coming to, to participate in all kinds of lectures, workshops, experience the city of Chicago, let us show off a bit, you know, have some pizza and hot dogs and show what Chicago's all about. And everybody's really excited. You know, it's interesting. They looked at the national organization looked at quite a few different places where we could hold a conference. And, we really tried to sell it to the committee as, you know, we're the heart of the country. We're right in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
We're the heart. So come and enjoy us. So we're super excited about it.
That's going to be awesome. All right. The way we always end this podcast, and I'm going to make you do it, is to tell us a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, groups of people making something out of nothing, which we discussed, you'd get nowhere by saying no.
Okay.
And you actually don't get very far by saying yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
Yes, I do. So, like most human beings, I went through a somewhat rough patch in my life when my marriage ended. And I was feeling pretty lost, pretty devastated. And my tendency then was to kind of, you know, hunker down and, you know, lean into my family and lean into my Chicago Waldorf community. And that was extremely important. But I felt like I needed to sort of push myself in a way to kind of try to rediscover who I was now as this different person, new person, without losing myself. And so I had always had this fantasy since I was a child, and I don't know why, I have no idea where it came from, to go to New Zealand.
Mm.
And so I reached out to a bunch of Waldorf schools over there and said, I'm a teacher. I'll come over. I will do anything you need me to do, from substitute teach to clean the kitchens to work in the early childhood. I would just like an experience in your country. And one school responded, and the night before I agreed I would go, and the night before I left, I had a panic attack because I was like, what the hell am I doing? I'm going on the other side of the world where I don't know anyone, leaving all my safety nets behind, all my safety net behind. What am I doing? But I got on the plane and I went there, and I spent 4 months at Te Ra School on the Kapiti coast of New Zealand, and it was a life-changing experience because it allowed me to allowed me to heal a lot of broken places. It also allowed me to remember who I was at my core, and it allowed me to stretch myself in ways that I just never could have imagined possible for me. At 50, I was 50 years old. I wasn't a kid. And so I went to a new part of the world and found a new part of myself.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Because, you know, I certainly understand and have said the phrase, you know, you're going to take yourself with you when you go someplace. And that's true. But there is something about being in different spaces.
Yes.
That is hugely important. And sometimes that can be a different space in your city.
Yeah.
And sometimes it needs to be across the world.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
I don't know that any of us will know when that particular time comes, but I sometimes think that the good forces around us are pushing us to do those things, right?
I think so too.
So that's part of the yes and when you
absolutely.
Yeah. Carol Trigiano, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Kelly. I had a wonderful time.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.